Hi everyone, Roger Browning here again for tutorial number two in the mini tutorial series on patient blood management for obstetrics and gynecology. Please have a listen to the first one if you haven't already. So we're going to try and stick to a 10 minute or 10 or 12 minute time frame. So I know this is a bit of a dry topic. I'm going to try and make it as easy to understand as possible. So please stick with me because I think it's really important for the other discussions on oral iron, intravenous iron, interpretation of laboratory results, etc., that if you don't have the basic knowledge of how iron is handled by the body, it's pretty hard to put it into the right context. Who needs to understand the basic sort of iron physiology? Well, I would put it to you that we all do. Anyone who looks after an obstetrical or gynecological patient who is anemic or has iron deficiency, which is extremely common, should understand the basics. You don't have to obviously be a world expert or a hematologist, but we should all be able to talk to each other and understand what we're on about in the same language. So stay with me for the next 9 or 10 minutes, and hopefully at the end of that you might have brushed up on this stuff and feel that you've got something out of it. Now, quick plug for this website again. I'm not an expert in iron metabolism or iron deficiency anemia. I did know a bit about it, but I have recently gone back and checked up on it. I did this learning package myself only in the last few days, and it's really good. I thoroughly encourage anyone who works in obstetrics and gynecology to make sure you do this, because probably more than 50% of your patients are going to have iron deficiency and iron deficiency anemia, and therefore it is bread and butter in your practice. Okay, so iron metabolism. Now, this is a tough one to teach without putting you to sleep. But I am going to try and synthesize in the next 4 slides the essence of what I think is the basics that we should probably start off with knowing. Hopefully we'll build on that. If you stay with me in these little mini talks, then when we go into some of the other discussions on, that I put together on oral iron and intravenous iron and some cases, some hypothetical cases, you know, we might be able to sort of build on some of the knowledge. But here we go. So slide number one and concept number one, I think, which is really important, is understanding where is iron in the body. So the first thing you need to know is this represents the average sort of adult person who is not anemic and is iron replete. So most of the iron in your body is kept was contained in the hemoglobin in your red blood cells. So you can see here that most adults have 3 to 4 grams or 3,000 to 4,000 milligrams of iron in their body, of which the majority, 3,000 milligrams, is in their red blood cells. And people who are not iron deficient have 500 to 1,000 milligrams in the reticuloendothelial stores, which are basically the macrophages, which are located in the liver and the bone marrow. By and large, there are smaller amounts of iron in your body, doing all the heavy lifting in myoglobin and things like your mitochondria, and also bound to transferrin. But that's not where the majority of it is. Obviously, they're doing an important job. Quick point to mention, and we'll go into this more with intravenous iron. So, if you lose acute blood loss, say you lose half your blood volume, you're unlucky enough to be having a major cancer operation or a big postpartum hemorrhage, then you've obviously lost quite a large amount of the iron in your body, such that you that it might not be initially reflected in things like iron studies, because obviously it'll take a bit of time for everything to redistribute. But that's an important concept to get your head around. So it is important to remember these rough numbers of iron in the body. Now, this is the bit where I probably need you to try and concentrate a bit. I guess the beauty of recording is you can go back and forward a little bit if you go to sleep at some stage. So what I'm going to try and do is explain how iron is handled by the body in the most basic way I can. So the first thing is that iron is not actively excreted from the body. So the only way that we regulate how much iron we have in our body is by regulating how much we absorb. So iron is absorbed by and large from the intestinal lumen across the intestinal lumen into the body, i.e. you swallow a bit of meat, spinach or a ferrograde tablet, It comes down into the intestinal lumen, if you can see the cursor here. Most of it is actually absorbed, or it's pretty easily absorbed into the enterocytes, the cells that line the gut. And then the regulation point occurs here. So there's a protein molecule, or an active transport molecule here called ferroportin. Now, if you have lots of ferroportin here, they're located in these cells, then the iron is then pumped across the membrane into the body, bound to transferrin, and is sent off to the bone marrow or to be stored for future use. And if you have enough iron in your body and you don't need any more iron, or you have some pathological state whereby you can't absorb iron, usually there is not enough or not very many ferroportin molecules, the iron stays trapped in the enterocytes, which are shed every couple of days, and the iron ends up going passing out of the gastrointestinal tract in your feces, and you don't absorb it. So that's pretty much how it's regulated on the absorption front. So what is it that regulates it? It's this molecule here called hepcidin, which is the regulatory hormone which controls iron absorption. So if you have lots of hepcidin, if hepcidin levels go up, that causes a decrease in the number of ferroportin molecules. So you will have, and that will decrease your absorption of iron into the body. So in healthy individuals, if you have enough iron in your body, you're not anemic and you're not iron deficient, you usually have a higher hepcidin, and that will mean that the iron that you eat, you know, by and large, most of it doesn't get transported across and you don't absorb it because you don't need it. Sometimes people have pathological states which lead to inflammation, like renal failure, cancer, post major surgery, or just sepsis or infections or inflammatory bowel disease. Anything which is an inflammatory condition can also lead to high hepcidin levels. And in this situation, even though you may well actually be anemic or have true iron deficiency, because you have high hepcidin, you can't absorb iron from the gut, and that may impair your ability to correct these individuals with oral iron. So that's an important concept to understand, I guess. Another perhaps important concept is that ferroportin is actually the molecule that is located on the macrophages where the iron is stored. And so whenever hepcidin goes up, the number of ferroportin molecules on those sites go down as well. And so you can develop a condition called functional iron deficiency, whereby because of the high hepcidin levels, you have trouble getting the iron from your iron stores. Even though you have some there, you can't get it from there into the bloodstream, into the bone marrow. So the bone marrow has trouble making hemoglobin because it can't get any iron from the bone from the stores, and that's a condition called functional iron deficiency. But I'm not going to go into that because I think that's a bit more complicated than straightforward basics that we need to go over today. All right. Whew. Hopefully I'm doing a good job staying to time, and hopefully I'm keeping your attention. please don't turn me off. I reckon we're past the halfway mark. All right. Laboratory tests. In my humble opinion, the most important laboratory test is not actually a laboratory test. It's talking to the patient. So the most important thing is taking a patient history, and you know, they will often describe to you menorrhagia for many years. Blood tests done 5 years ago when they had the same thing showed a low iron, you know, they've been pregnant, or they are pregnant, or have been pregnant recently, all of those things, and now they've describe the symptoms and a good story for why they might be iron deficient. It's almost always, in my experience anyway, talking to patients in the pre-admission clinic obstetric patients, you know, can almost tell what the results of the iron studies which you order are going to show, which you do need to do, obviously, because you've got to confirm things, but it's often you know the answer before you send it. So that is the most important thing. And it is also really important that if someone has a low ferritin or is diagnosed with iron deficiency or anemia, if they don't have a good story, then you really should be ringing a few alarm bells and making sure that they get appropriately worked up for some, find the cause, basically, because there are some serious occult GI pathologies which you don't want to miss. Cancer, celiac disease, peptic ulcer disease, and the like. Okay, quick skim over this. We can go into more depth about things later on in some of the other talks. So the definitions: if you're a female and your hemoglobin is less than 120 when you're not pregnant, that's considered anemia. It's only 110 if you are pregnant because of the dilutional anemia that occurs in pregnancy. Things on the full blood count which might be useful but and which can trigger your suspicion of iron deficiency are a low mean cell volume, low mean cell hemoglobin, or a high red cell distribution width. We're not going to get all technical, but basically those are signs that the bone marrow is having trouble making hemoglobin because it hasn't got enough iron. So the red cells that are spitting out have all these changes in them, which are brought about by deficient hemoglobin production. Now, there are other things that can cause this, like thalassemia being the most important and most common. So that is something you should keep in mind as well. However, if you have someone who's not known thalassemia, if they have a good story of menorrhagia or if they're pregnant, don't forget to check their iron studies because they often coexist, and they will still you can obviously still correct them their anemia and their iron deficiency. So don't. That's probably the most common mistake, I guess, with a low MCV in someone with thalassemia. Iron studies. So most laboratories, and certainly our one in my institution, now define iron deficiency as a ferritin less than 30. So it was less than 15 in the past. So I guess 15 to 30 is the new sort of grey zone. But pretty much, if people have a good story and it's less than 30, then it's iron deficiency. You can still have iron deficiency if your ferritin's between 30 to 100, but you have a good reason for it to be raised, like you've just had a big operation, or you have inflammatory bowel disease or some other inflammatory condition. And then ferritin greater than 100 is unlikely that you have iron deficiency anemia, but you can still get something called a functional iron deficiency, which we're not going to talk about. Quick plug, so this comes straight out of the National Blood Authority guidelines. This is for their perioperative patient. Perioperative patient module, so directly applicable to all of our gynecological and gyne-oncology or gyne-urology patients who are having surgery. This is the flow chart and the algorithm they use for working people up and correcting their anemias before surgery. And really useful. I'm not going to go through it, but have a look at it. Goes over the same sort of things we've just mentioned. Some really good tips up in the left corner here, including the fact that if the preoperative ferritin is less than 100 and you're expecting a large blood loss, then you might need to try and replete that iron stores in those patients. That approximately 165 milligrams of iron is required to increase your hemoglobin by 10 grams per litre. And also that 1 mL of blood has got 1.5 milligrams of iron. So if you lose a litre of blood, you've lost about 500 milligrams of iron. I think I've got that on the next slide. Those are all like neat little mental points to remember, and it helps you when you're thinking about things and assessing patients. So summary, a couple of slides to go, almost finished. Ferritin less than 30, probably iron deficiency, especially a good story on history. 1,000 mils of blood is about 500 or 600 milligrams of iron. In pregnancy, we didn't mention this, but you should know that this during pregnancy, your woman usually need 800 to 1,000 milligrams of iron. Another point to remember, people who have high hepcidin states, oral iron is not going to work very well as dietary iron. So they just can't get it across the GI tract, so that is really useful, and we're going to talk about that in the next talk. And don't forget, there are other causes of anemia, and you should always be asking for help and advice from more learned colleagues in patients where it's not really a straightforward scenario. And then, final plug, blood safe learning, plug at the beginning and the end, go and do it, it's really good. National Blood Authority Patient Blood Management Guidelines, they're really easy to read, they've got some great practice points also, go and have a look at them. Okay, thanks for staying with me.